Tom was horrified. There would be mayhem. Suddenly he saw Jack right beside him, looking up at him with an expression of amusement. "Why are you standing on a barrel?" he said.
"There's going to be trouble," Tom said urgently. "Where's your mother?"
"At Aliena's stall."
"What sort of trouble?"
"Bad. Where are Alfred and Martha?"
"Martha's with Mother. Alfred's watching the cockfighting."
"What is it?"
"See for yourself."
Tom gave Jack a hand up. Jack stood precariously on the rim of the barrel in front of Tom. The riders were pounding across the bridge into the village. Jack said, "Christ Jesus, who are they?" Tom peered at the leader, a big man on a war horse. He recognized the yellow hair and heavy build.
"It's William Hamley," he said.
As the riders reached the houses, they touched their torches to the roofs, setting fire to the thatch.
"They're burning the town," Jack exploded.
"It's going to be even worse than I thought," Tom said.
"Get down."
They both jumped to the ground.
"I'll get Mother and Martha," Jack said.
"Take them to the cloisters," Tom said urgently.
"It will be the only safe place. If the monks object, tell them to go shit."
"What if they lock the door?"
"I just broke the lock. Go quickly. I'll fetch Alfred. Go!"
Jack hurried away. Tom headed for the cockpit, roughly pushing people aside. Several men objected to his shoving, but he ignored them, and they shut up when they saw his size and the look of stony determination on his face. It was not long before the smoke of the burning houses blew into the priory close. Tom smelled it, and he noticed one or two other people sniffing the air curiously. He had only a few moments left before panic broke out. The cockpit was near the priory gate. There was a large, noisy crowd around it. Tom shoved through, looking for Alfred. In the middle of the crowd was a shallow hole in the ground a few feet across. In the center of the hole, two cocks were tearing each other to pieces with beaks and spurred claws. There were feathers and blood everywhere. Alfred was near the front, watching intently, yelling at the top of his voice, encouraging one or other of the wretched birds. Tom forced his way between the packed people and grabbed Alfred's shoulder.
"Come!"
he shouted.
"I've got sixpence on the black one!"
Alfred shouted back.
"We've got to get out of here!"
Tom yelled. At that moment a drift of smoke blew over the cockpit.
"Can't you smell the fire?"
One or two of the spectators heard the word fire, and looked at Tom curiously. The smell came again and they picked it up. Alfred smelled it too.
"What is it?"
he said.
"The town is on fire!"
Tom said. Suddenly everyone wanted to leave. The men dispersed in all directions, pushing and shoving. In the pit, the black cock killed the brown, but nobody cared any more. Alfred started to go the wrong way. Tom grabbed him.
"We'll go to the cloisters," he said.
"It's the only safe place."
The smoke began to come over in billows, and fear spread through the crowd. Everyone was agitated, but no one knew what to do. Looking over the heads, Tom could see that people were pouring out through the priory gate, but the gate was narrow, and anyway, they were no safer out there than in here. Nevertheless, more people got the idea, and he and Alfred found themselves struggling against a tide of people frantically going in the opposite direction. Then, quite suddenly, the tide turned and everyone was going their way. Tom looked around to discover the reason for the change, and saw the first of the horsemen ride into the close. At that point, the crowd became a mob. The riders were a terrifying sight. Their huge horses, just as frightened as the crowd, plunged and reared and charged, trampling people left, right, and center. The armed and helmeted riders laid about them with clubs and torches, felling men, women, and children, and setting fire to stalls, clothes, and people's hair. Everyone was screaming. More riders came through the gate, and more people disappeared beneath the massive hooves. Tom shouted in Alfred's ear,
"You go on to the cloisters! I want to make sure the others have got clear! Run!"
He gave him a shove. Alfred took off. Tom headed for Aliena's stall. Almost immediately, he tripped over someone and fell to the ground. Cursing, he got to his knees. But before he could stand upright, he saw a warhorse bearing down on him. The beast's ears were back and its nostrils were flared, and Tom could see the whites of its terrified eyes. Above the horse's head, Tom saw the beefy face of William Hamley distorted into a grimace of hatred and triumph. The thought flashed through his mind that it would be nice to hold Ellen in his arms once again. Then a massive hoof kicked him in the exact center of his forehead. He felt a dreadful, frightening pain as his skull seemed to burst open,
and the whole world went black. The first time Aliena smelled smoke, she thought it was coming from the dinner she was serving. Three Flemish buyers were sitting at the table in the open air in front of her storehouse. They were corpulent, black-bearded men who spoke English with a heavy Germanic accent and wore clothes of exquisitely fine cloth. Everything was going well. She was close to starting the selling and had decided to serve lunch first in order to give the buyers time to get anxious. Nevertheless, she would be glad when this vast fortune in wool became someone else's. She put the platter of honey-roast pork chops in front of them and looked critically at it. The meat was done to a turn, with the border of fat just crisp and brown. She poured more wine. One of the buyers sniffed the air. Then they all looked around anxiously. Aliena was suddenly fearful. Fire was the wool merchant's nightmare. She looked at Ellen and Martha, who were helping her serve dinner. "Can you smell smoke?" she said. Before they could reply, Jack appeared. Aliena had not got used to seeing him in a monk's habit, with his carrot-coloured hair shaved from the top of his head. There was an agitated look on his sweet face. She felt a sudden urge to take him in her arms and kiss away the frown on his forehead. But she turned away quickly, remembering how she had let herself down with him in the old mill 6 months ago. She still flushed for shame every time she recalled that incident. "There's trouble!" he shouted urgently. "We must all take refuge in the cloisters!" She looked at him. "What's happening? Is there a fire?" "It's Earl William and his men-at-arms," he said. Aliena suddenly felt as cold as the grave. William. Again. Jack said, "They've set fire to the town. Tom and Alfred are going to the cloisters. Come with me, please." Ellen unceremoniously dropped the bowl of greens she was carrying onto the table in front of a startled Flemish buyer. "Right," she said. She grabbed Martha by the arm. "Let's go." Aliena shot a panicky look at her storehouse. She had hundreds of pounds' worth of raw wool in there that she had to protect from fire. But how? She caught Jack's eye. He was looking at her expectantly. The buyers left the table hurriedly. Aliena said to Jack, "Go. I have to look after my stall." Ellen said, "Jack, come on!" "In a moment," he said, and turned back to Aliena. Aliena saw Ellen hesitate. She was clearly torn between saving Martha and waiting for Jack. Again she said, "Jack, Jack!" He turned to her. "Mother, take Martha." "All right," she said, "but please, hurry!" She and Martha left. Jack said, "The town is on fire. The cloisters will be the safest place. They're made of stone. Come with me, quickly." Aliena could hear screams from the direction of the priory gate. The smoke was suddenly everywhere. She looked all around, trying to make out what was happening. Her insides were knotted with fear. Everything she had worked for over 6 years, was stacked up in the storehouse. Jack said, "Aliena, come to the cloisters. We'll be safe there." "I can't," she shouted. "My wool!" "To hell with your wool! It's all I've got. It's no good to you if you're dead." "It's easy for you to say that, but I've spent all these years getting to this position. Aliena, please!" Suddenly the people right outside the stall were screaming in mortal terror. The riders had entered the priory close and were charging through the crowds, regardless of whom they trampled, setting fire to the stalls. Terror-stricken people were crushing one another in their desperate attempts to get out of the way of the flying hooves and the firebrands. The crowd pressed against the flimsy wooden hurdle that formed the front of Aliena's stall, and it immediately collapsed. People spilled onto the open space in front of the storehouse and upset the table with its plates of food and cups of wine. Jack and Aliena were forced back. Two riders charged into the stall, one swinging a club at random, the other brandishing a flaming torch. Jack pushed himself in front of Aliena, shielding her. The club came down at Aliena's head, but Jack threw a protective arm over her, and the club smashed down on his wrist. She felt the blow, but he took the impact. When she looked up, she saw the face of the second rider. It was William Hamley. Aliena screamed. He looked at her for a moment with the torch blazing in his hand and the light of triumph glittering in his eyes. Then he kicked his horse and forced it into her storehouse.
"No!"
Aliena screamed. She struggled to escape from the crush, shoving and punching those around her, including Jack. At last she got free and dashed into the storehouse. William was leaning out from the saddle, putting his torch to the piled sacks of wool.
No!
She screamed again. She threw herself at him and tried to pull him off the horse. He brushed her aside, and she fell to the ground. He held his torch to the wool sacks again. The wool caught fire with a mighty roar. The horse reared and screamed in terror at the flames. Suddenly, Jack was there, pulling Aliena out of the way. William wheeled the horse and went out of the storehouse fast. Aliena got to her feet. She picked up an empty sack and tried to beat the flames out. Jack said, "Aliena, you'll be killed!" The heat became agonizing. She grabbed at a wool sack that was not yet on fire and tried to pull it free. Suddenly she heard a roaring in her ears and felt intense heat on her face, and she realized in terror that her hair was on fire. An instant later, Jack threw himself at her, wrapping his arms around her head and pulling her tightly against his body. They both fell to the ground. He held her hard for a moment, then loosed his hold. She smelled singed hair, but it was no longer burning. She could see that Jack's face was burned, and his eyebrows had gone. He grabbed her by one ankle and dragged her out through the door. He kept on pulling her, despite her struggles, until they were well clear. The area of her stall had emptied. Jack released his hold on her. She tried to get up, but he grabbed her and held her down. She continued to struggle, staring madly at the fire that was consuming all her years of work and worry, all her wealth and security, until she had no energy left to fight him. Then she just lay there and screamed. Philip was in the undercroft beneath the Priory kitchen, counting money with Cuthbert Whitehead, when he heard the noise. He and Cuthbert looked at one another, frowning, then got up to see what was going on. They stepped through the door into a riot. Philip was horrified. People were running in every direction, pushing and shoving, falling over and treading on one another. Men and women were shouting and children were crying. The air was full of smoke. Everyone seemed to be trying to get out of the Priory Close. Apart from the main gate, the only exit was through the gap between the kitchen buildings and the mill. There was no wall there, but there was a deep ditch that carried water from the mill pond to the brewery. Philip wanted to warn people to be careful of the ditch, but nobody was listening to anyone. The cause of the rush was obviously a fire, and a very big one. The air was thick with the smoke of it. Philip was full of fear. With this many people all crowded together, the slaughter could be appalling. What could be done? First he had to find out exactly what was going on. He ran up the steps to the kitchen door to get a better view. What he saw filled him with dread. The entire town of Kingsbridge was alight. A cry of horror and despair escaped his throat. How could this be happening? Then he saw the horsemen charging through the crowd with their burning firebrands, and he realized that it was not an accident. His first thought was that there was a battle going on between the two sides in the Civil War, and somehow it had engulfed Kingsbridge. But the men-at-arms were attacking the citizens, not one another. This was no battle. It was a massacre. He saw a large blonde man on a massive war horse crashing through the crowds of people. It was William Hamley. Hatred rose in Philip's gorge. To think that the slaughter and destruction going on all around had been caused deliberately for reasons of greed and pride drove him half mad. He shouted at the top of his voice, "I see you, William Hamley!" William heard his name called over the screams of the crowd. He reined in his horse and met Philip's eye. Philip yelled, "You'll go to hell for this!" William's face was suffused with bloodlust. Even the threat of what he feared most had no effect on him today. He was like a madman. He waved his firebrand in the air like a banner. "This is hell, monk!" he shouted back, and he wheeled his horse and rode on. Suddenly everyone had disappeared, the riders and the crowds. Jack released his hold on Aliena and stood up. His right hand felt numb. He remembered that he had taken the blow aimed at Aliena's head. He was glad his hand hurt. He hoped it would hurt for a long time to remind him. The storehouse was an inferno, and smaller fires burned all around. The ground was littered with bodies, some moving, some bleeding, some limp and still. Apart from the crackle of the flames, it was quiet. The mob had got out, one way or another, leaving their dead and wounded behind. Jack felt dazed. He had never seen a battlefield, but he imagined it must look like this. Aliena started to cry. Jack put a comforting hand on her shoulder. She pushed it off. He had saved her life, but she did not care for that. She cared only for her damned wool, which was now irretrievably lost in smoke. He looked at her for a moment, feeling sad. Most of her hair had burned away, and she no longer looked beautiful. But he loved her all the same. It hurt him to see her so distraught, and not to be able to comfort her. He felt sure she would not try to go into the storehouse now. He was worried about the rest of his family, so he left Aliena and went looking for them. His face hurt. He put a hand to his cheek, and his own touch stung him. He must have got burned, too. He looked at the bodies on the ground. He wanted to do something for the wounded, but he did not know where to begin. He searched for familiar faces among the strangers, hoping not to see any. Mother and Martha had gone to the cloisters. They had been well ahead of the mob, he thought. Had Tom found Alfred? He turned toward the cloisters. Then he saw Tom. His stepfather's tall body was stretched out full length on the muddy ground. It was perfectly still. His face was recognizable, even peaceful-looking, up to the eyebrows. But his forehead was open, and his skull was completely smashed. Jack was appalled. He could not take it in. Tom could not be dead. But this thing could not be alive. He looked away, then looked back. It was Tom, and he was dead. Jack knelt beside the body. He felt the urge to do something or say something, and for the first time he understood why people liked to pray for the dead. "Mother is going to miss you terribly," he said. He remembered the angry speech he had made to Tom on the day of his fight with Alfred. "Most of that wasn't true," he said, and the tears started to flow. "You didn't fail me. You fed me and took care of me, and you made my mother happy, truly happy." But there was something more important than all that, he thought. What Tom had given him was nothing so commonplace as food and shelter. Tom had given him something unique. Something no other man had to give. Something even his own father could not have given him. Something that was a passion, a skill, an art, and a way of life. "You gave me the cathedral," Jack whispered to the dead man. "Thank you." Part 4, 1142 to 1145. Chapter 11. William's triumph was ruined by Philip's prophecy. Instead of feeling satisfied and jubilant, he was terrified that he would go to hell for what he had done. He had answered Philip bravely enough, jeering, "This is hell, monk." But that had been in the excitement of the attack. When it was over, and he had led his men away from the blazing town, when their horses and their heartbeats had slowed down, when he had time to look back over the raid and think of how many people he had wounded and burned and killed, then he recalled Philip's angry face and his finger pointing straight down into the bowels of the earth, and the doom-laden words, "You'll go to hell for this." By the time darkness fell, he was completely depressed. His men-at-arms wanted to talk over the operation, reliving the high spots and relishing the slaughter, but they soon caught his mood and relapsed into gloomy silence. They spent that night at the manor house of one of William's larger tenants. At supper, the men grimly drank themselves senseless. The tenant, knowing how men normally felt after a battle, had brought in some whores from Shiring, but they did poor business. William lay awake all night, terrified that he might die in his sleep and go straight to hell. The following morning, instead of returning to Earl's Castle, he went to see Bishop Walleran. He was not at his palace when they arrived, but Dean Baldwin told William that he was expected that afternoon. William waited in the chapel, staring at the cross on the altar and shivering despite the summer heat. When Walleran arrived at last, William felt like kissing his feet. The bishop swept into the chapel in his black robes and said coldly, "What are you doing here?" William got to his feet, trying to hide his abject terror behind a facade of self-possession. "I've just burned down the town of Kingsbridge. I know, Walloran interrupted. I've been hearing about nothing else all day. What possessed you? Are you mad? This reaction took William completely by surprise. He had not discussed the raid with Walloran in advance because he had been so sure Walloran would approve. Walloran hated everything to do with Kingsbridge, especially Prior Philip. William had expected him to be pleased, if not gleeful. William said, "I've just ruined your greatest enemy. Now I need to confess my sins." "I'm not surprised," Walloran said. "They say more than 100 people burned to death." He shuddered. "A horrible way to die." "I'm ready to confess," William said. Walloran shook his head. "I don't know that I can give you absolution." A cry of fear escaped William's lips. "Why not?" "You know that Bishop Henry of Winchester and I have taken the side of King Stephen again. I don't think the king would approve of my giving absolution to a supporter of Queen Maud." "Damn you, Walloran. It was you who persuaded me to change sides." Walloran shrugged. "Change back." William realized that this was Walloran's objective. He wanted William to switch his allegiance to Stephen. Walloran's horror at the burning of Kingsbridge had been faked. He had simply been establishing a bargaining position. This realization brought enormous relief to William, for it meant that Walloran was not implacably opposed to giving him absolution. But did he want to switch again? For a moment he said nothing, as he tried to think about it calmly. "Stephen has been winning victories all summer," Walloran went on. "Maud is begging her husband to come over from Normandy to help her, but he won't. The tide is flowing our way." An awful prospect opened up before William. The church refused to absolve him from his crimes. The sheriff accused him of murder. A victorious King Stephen backed the sheriff and the church, and William himself was tried and hanged. "Be like me, and follow Bishop Henry. He knows which way the wind blows," Walloran urged. "If everything works out right, Winchester will be made an archdiocese, and Henry will be the Archbishop of Winchester, on a par with the Archbishop of Canterbury. And when Henry dies, who knows? I could be the next Archbishop. After that, well, there are English cardinals already. One day there may be an English Pope." William stared at Walloran, mesmerized, despite his own fear, by the naked ambition revealed on the bishop's normally stony face. Walloran as Pope? Anything was possible. But the immediate consequences of Walloran's aspirations were more important. William could see that he was a pawn in Walloran's game. Walloran had gained in prestige with Bishop Henry by his ability to deliver William and the Knights of Shiring to one side or the other in the Civil War. That was the price William had to pay for having the church turn a blind eye to his crimes. "Do you mean—" His voice was hoarse. He coughed and tried again. "Do you mean that you will hear my confession if I swear allegiance to Stephen and come over to his side again?" The glitter went from Walloran's eyes, and his face became expressionless again. "That's exactly what I mean," he said. William had no choice, but in any event, he could see no reason to refuse. He had switched to Maud when she appeared to be winning, and he was quite ready to switch back now that Stephen seemed to be gaining the upper hand. Anyway, he would have consented to anything to be free of that awful terror of hell. "Agreed, then," he said without further hesitation. "Only hear my confession, quickly." "Very well," said Walloran. "Let us pray." As they went briskly through the service, William felt the load of guilt fall from his back, and he gradually began to be pleased about his triumph. When he emerged from the chapel, his men could see that his spirits had lifted, and they cheered up immediately. William told them that they would once again be fighting for King Stephen, in accordance with the will of God, as expressed by Bishop Walloran, and they made that the excuse for a celebration. Walloran called for wine. While they were waiting for dinner, William said, "Stephen ought to confirm me in my earldom now." "He ought to," Walloran agreed, "but that doesn't mean he will. But I've come over to his side. Richard of Kingsbridge never left it." William permitted himself a smug smile.
I think I've disposed of the threat from Richard.
Oh? How?
Richard has never had any land. The only way he's been able to keep up a knightly entourage is by using his sister's money. It's unorthodox, but it's worked so far. But now his sister no longer has any money. I set fire to her barn yesterday. She's destitute, and so is Richard. Walleran nodded acknowledgement. In that case, it's only a matter of time before he disappears from sight. And then, I should think, the earldom is yours.
Dinner was ready. William's men-at-arms sat below the salt and flirted with the palace laundresses. William was at the head of the table with Walleran and his archdeacons. Now that he had relaxed, William rather envied the men with the laundresses. Archdeacons made dull company. Dean Baldwin offered William a dish of peas and said, "Lord William, how will you prevent someone else from doing what Prior Philip tried to do, and starting his own fleece fair?" William was surprised by this question. They wouldn't dare. Another monk wouldn't dare, perhaps. But an earl might. He'd need a license. He might get one, if he fought for Stephen. Not in this county.
"Baldwin is right, William," said Bishop Walleran. "All around the borders of your earldom there are towns that could hold a fleece fair. Wilton, Devizes, Wells, Marlborough, Wallingford. I burned Kingsbridge. I can burn any place," William said irritably. He took a swallow of wine. It angered him to have his victory deprecated. Walleran took a roll of new bread and broke it without eating any.
"Kingsbridge is an easy target," he argued. "It has no town wall, no castle, not even a big church for people to take refuge in. And it's run by a monk who has no knights or men-at-arms. Kingsbridge is defenceless. Most towns aren't."
Dean Baldwin added, "And when the civil war is over, whoever wins, you won't be able to burn a town like Kingsbridge and get away with it. That's breaking the king's peace. No king could overlook it in normal times." William saw their point, and it made him angry. "Then the whole thing might have been for nothing," he said. He put down his knife. His stomach was cramped with tension, and he could no longer eat. Walleran said, "Of course, if Aliena is ruined, that leaves a kind of vacancy." William did not follow him.
"What do you mean?"
"Most of the wool in the county was sold to her this year. What will happen next year?"
"I don't know."
Walleran continued in the same thoughtful manner. "Apart from Prior Philip, all the wool producers for miles around are either tenants of the earl or tenants of the bishop. You're the earl, in everything but name, and I'm the bishop. If we forced all our tenants to sell their fleeces to us, we would control two-thirds of the wool trade in the county. We would sell at the Shiring Fleece Fair. There wouldn't be enough business left to justify another fair, even if someone got a license."
It was a brilliant idea, William saw immediately. "And we'd make as much money as Aliena did," he pointed out.
"Indeed."
Walleran took a delicate bite of the meat in front of him and chewed reflectively.
"So you've burned Kingsbridge, ruined your worst enemy, and established a new source of income for yourself. Not a bad day's work."
William took a deep draught of wine and felt a glow in his belly. He looked down the table, and his eye lit on a plump, dark-haired girl who was smiling coquettishly at two of his men. Perhaps he would have her tonight. He knew how it would be. When he got her in a corner and threw her on the floor and lifted her skirt, he would remember Aliena's face and the expression of terror and despair as she saw her wool going up in flames, and then he would be able to do it. He smiled at the prospect and took another slice off the haunch of venison. Prior Philip was shaken to the core by the burning of Kingsbridge. The unexpectedness of William's move, the brutality of the attack, the dreadful scenes as the crowd panicked, the awful slaughter and his own utter impotence, all combined to leave him stunned. Worst of all was the death of Tom Builder. A man at the height of his skill, and a master of every aspect of his craft, Tom had been expected to continue to manage the building of the cathedral until it was finished. He was also Philip's closest friend outside the cloisters. They had talked at least once a day, and struggled together to find solutions to the endless variety of problems that confronted them in their vast project. Tom had had a rare combination of wisdom and humility that made him a joy to work with. It seemed impossible that he was gone. Philip felt that he did not understand anything anymore. He had no real power, and he was not competent to be in charge of a cowshed, much less a town the size of Kingsbridge. He had always believed that if he did his honest best and trusted in God, everything would turn out well in the end. The burning of Kingsbridge seemed to have proved him wrong. He lost all motivation and sat in his house at the Priory all day long, watching the candle burn down on the little altar, thinking disconnected, desolate thoughts, doing nothing. It was young Jack who saw what had to be done. He got the dead bodies taken to the crypt, put the wounded in the monk's dormitory, and organized emergency feeding for the living in the meadow on the other side of the river. The weather was warm, and everyone slept in the open air. The day after the massacre, Jack organized the day's townspeople into teams of laborers, and got them to clear the ashes and debris from the Priory Close, while Cuthbert Whitehead and Milius Bursa ordered supplies of food from surrounding farms. On the second day they buried their dead in 193 new graves on the north side of the Priory Close. Philip simply issued the orders that Jack proposed. Jack pointed out that most of the citizens who had survived the fire had lost very little of material value, just a hovel and a few sticks of furniture in most cases. The crops were still in the fields, the livestock were in the pastures, and people's savings were still where they had been buried, usually beneath the hearth of their homes, untouched by the above-ground blaze that had swept the town. The merchants whose stocks had burned were the greatest sufferers. Some were ruined, as Aliena was. Others had some of their wealth in buried silver and would be able to start again. Jack proposed rebuilding the town immediately. At Jack's suggestion, Philip gave extraordinary permission for timber to be cut freely in the Priory's forests for the purpose of rebuilding houses, but only for 1 week. In consequence, Kingsbridge was deserted for 7 days while every family selected and felled the trees they would use for their new homes. During that week, Jack asked Philip to draw a plan of the new town. The idea caught Philip's imagination, and he came out of his depression. He worked on his plan non-stop for 4 days. There would be large houses all around the Priory walls for the wealthy craftsmen and shopkeepers. He recalled the grid pattern of Winchester's streets and planned the new Kingsbridge on the same convenient basis. Straight streets, broad enough for 2 carts to pass, would run down to the river with narrower cross streets. He made the standard building plot 24 feet wide, which was an ample frontage for a townhouse. Each plot would be 120 feet deep, to make room for a decent backyard with a privy, a vegetable garden, and a stable, cowshed, or pigsty. The bridge had burned down, and the new one would be built in a more convenient position, at the bottom end of the new main street. The main road through the town would now go from the bridge straight up the hill, past the cathedral and out the far side, as in Lincoln. Another wide street would run from the Priory Gate to a new quay at the riverside, downstream from the bridge and around the bend in the river. That way, bulk supplies could reach the Priory without using the main shopping street. There would be a completely new district of small houses around the new quay. The poor would be downstream of the Priory, and their dirty habits would not foul the supply of fresh water to the monastery. Planning the rebuilding brought Philip out of his helpless trance, but every time he looked up from his drawings, he was swept by rage and grief for the people who had been lost. He wondered whether William Hamley was in fact the devil incarnate. He caused more misery than seemed humanly possible. Philip saw the same alternation of hope and bereavement on the faces of the townspeople as they arrived back from the forest with their loads of timber. Jack and the other monks had laid out the plan of the new town on the ground with stakes and string, and as the people chose their plots, every now and again someone would say gloomily, "But what's the point? It might be burned again next year." If there had been some hope of justice, some expectation that the evildoers might be punished, perhaps the people would not have been so inconsolable. But although Philip had written to Stephen, Maud, Bishop Henry, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and the Pope, he knew that in wartime there was little chance that a man as powerful and important as William
would be brought to trial. The larger building plots in Philip's scheme were much in demand, despite higher rents, so he altered his plan to allow for more of them. Almost nobody wanted to build in the poorer quarter, but Philip decided to leave the layout as it was for future use. 10 days after the fire, new wooden houses were going up on most plots, and another week later, most of them were finished. Once the people had built their houses, work started again on the cathedral. The builders got paid and wanted to spend their money, so the shops reopened, and the smallholders brought their eggs and onions into town, and the scullery maids and laundresses recommenced work for the shopkeepers and craftsmen, and so, day by day, material life in Kingsbridge returned to normal. But there were so many dead that it seemed like a town of ghosts. Every family had lost at least one member, a child, a mother, a husband, a sister. The people wore no badges of mourning, but the lines of their faces showed grief as starkly as bare trees show winter. One of the worst hit was 6-year-old Jonathan. He moped about the priory close like a lost soul, and eventually Philip realized he was missing Tom, who had, it seemed, spent more time with the boy than anyone had noticed. Once Philip understood this, he took care to set aside an hour each day for Jonathan, to tell him stories, play counting games, and listen to his voluble chatter. Philip wrote to the abbots of all the major Benedictine monasteries in England and France, asking them if they could recommend a master builder to replace Tom. A prior in Philip's position would normally consult his bishop about this, for bishops travelled widely and were likely to hear of good builders, but Bishop Walleran would not help Philip. The fact that the two of them were permanently at odds made Philip's job lonelier than it should have been. While Philip waited for replies from the abbots, the craftsman looked instinctively to Alfred for leadership. Alfred was Tom's son, he was a master mason, and he had for some time been operating his own semi-autonomous team on the site. He did not have Tom's brain, unfortunately, but he was literate and authoritative, and he slipped gradually into the gap left by the death of his father. There seemed to be a lot more problems and queries about the building than there had been in Tom's time, and Alfred always seemed to come up with a question when Jack was nowhere to be found. No doubt that was natural. Everyone in Kingsbridge knew the stepbrothers hated one another. However, the upshot was that Philip found himself once again bothered by endless questions of detail. But as the weeks went by, Alfred gained in confidence, until one day he came to Philip and said, "Wouldn't you rather have the cathedral vaulted?" Tom's design called for a wooden ceiling over the center of the church, and vaulted stone ceilings over the narrow side aisles. "Yes, I would," Philip said, "but we decided on a wooden ceiling to save money." Alfred nodded. "The trouble is, a wooden ceiling can burn. A stone vault is fireproof." Philip studied him for a moment, wondering whether he had underestimated Alfred. Philip would not have expected Alfred to propose a variation on his father's design. That was more the kind of thing Jack would do. But the idea of a fireproof church was very striking, especially since the whole town had burned down. Thinking along the same lines, Alfred said, "The only building left standing in the town after the fire was the new parish church." And the new parish church, built by Alfred, had a stone vault, Philip thought. But a snag occurred to him. Would the existing walls take the extra weight of a stone roof? "We'd have to reinforce the buttresses. They'd stick out a bit more, that's all." He had really thought this out, Philip realized. What about the cost? "It will cost more in the long run, of course, and the whole church will take 3 or 4 extra years to complete, but it won't make any difference to your annual outlay." Philip liked the idea more and more. "But will it mean we have to wait another year before we can use the chancel for services?" "No. Stone or wood, we can't start on the ceiling until next spring, because the clerestory must harden before we put any weight on it. The wood ceiling is quicker to build by a few months, but either way the chancel would be roofed by the end of next year." Philip considered. It was a matter of balancing the advantage of a fireproof roof against the disadvantage of another 4 years of building, and another 4 years of cost. The extra cost seemed a long way in the future, and the gain in safety was immediate. "I think I'll discuss it with the brothers in chapter," he said,
but it sounds like a good idea to me." Alfred thanked him and went out, and after he had gone, Philip sat staring at the door, wondering whether he really needed to search for a new master builder after all. Kingsbridge made a brave show on Lammas Day. In the morning every household in the town made a loaf. The harvest was just in, so flour was cheap and plentiful. Those who did not have an oven of their own baked their loaf at a neighbour's house, or in the vast ovens belonging to the priory and the town's two bakers, Peggy Baxter and Jack Atsnoven. By midday, the air was full of the smell of new bread, making everyone hungry. The loaves were displayed on tables set up in the meadow across the river, and everyone walked around admiring them. No two were alike. Many had fruit or spices inside. There was plum bread, raisin bread, gingerbread, sugar bread, onion bread, garlic bread, and many more. Others were colored green with parsley, yellow with egg yolk, red with sandalwood, or purple with turnsole. There were lots of odd shapes, triangles, cones, balls, stars, ovals, pyramids, flutes, rolls, and even figures of eight. Others were even more ambitious. There were loaves in the shapes of rabbits, bears, monkeys, and dragons. There were houses and castles of bread, but the most magnificent, by general agreement, was the loaf made by Ellen and Martha, which was a representation of the cathedral as it would look when finished, based on the design by her late husband, Tom. Ellen's grief had been terrible to see. She had wailed like a soul in torment night after night, and no one had been able to comfort her. Even now, 2 months later, she was haggard and hollow-eyed. But she and Martha seemed able to help one another, and making the bread cathedral had given them some kind of consolation. Aliena spent a long time staring at Ellen's construction. She wished there was something she could do to find comfort. She had no enthusiasm for anything. When the tasting began, she went from table to table listlessly, not eating. She had not even wanted to build a house for herself, until Prior Philip told her to snap out of it, and Alfred brought her the wood and assigned some of his men to help her. She was still eating at the monastery every day, when she remembered to eat at all. She had no energy. If it occurred to her to do something for herself, make a kitchen bench from leftover timber, or finish the walls of her house by filling in the chinks with mud from the river, or make a snare to catch birds so that she could feed herself, she would remember how hard she had worked to build up her trade as a wool merchant, and how quickly it had all gone to ruin, and she would lose her enthusiasm. So she went on from day to day, getting up late, going to the monastery for dinner if she felt hungry, spending the day watching the river flow by, and going to sleep in the straw on the floor of her new house when darkness fell. Despite her lassitude, she knew that this Lammas Day festival was no more than a pretense. The town had been rebuilt, and people were going about their business as before, but the massacre threw a long shadow, and she could sense beneath the facade of well-being a deep undercurrent of fear. Most people were better than Aliena at acting as if all was well. But in truth they all felt, as she did, that this could not last, and whatever they built now would be destroyed again. While she stood looking vacantly at the piles of bread, her brother Richard arrived. He came across the bridge from the deserted town, leading his horse. He had been away fighting for Stephen since before the massacre, and he was astonished by what he found. "What the devil happened here?" he said to her. "I can't find her house. The whole town has changed." "William Hamley came on the day of the fleece fair, with a troop of men-at-arms, and burned the town," Aliena said. Richard paled with shock, and the scar on his right ear showed livid. "William," he breathed, "that devil." "We've got a new house, though," Aliena said expressionlessly. "Alfred's men built it for me, but it's much smaller, and it's down by the new quay." "What happened to you?" he said, staring at her. "You're practically bald, and you've got no eyebrows." "My hair caught fire." "He didn't." Aliena shook her head. "Not this time." One of the girls brought Richard some salt bread to taste. He took some, but did not eat it. He looked stunned. "I'm glad you're safe, anyway," Aliena said. He nodded. "Stephen is marching on Oxford, where Maud is holed up. The war could be over soon, but I need a new sword. I came to get some money. He ate some bread. The color came back to his face. By God, this tastes good. You can cook me some meat later. Suddenly she was afraid of him. She knew he was going to be furious with her, and she had no strength to stand up to him. I haven't any meat, she said. Well, get some from the butcher, then. Don't be angry, Richard, she said. She began to tremble. I'm not angry, he said irritably. What's the matter with you? All my wool was burned in the fire, she said, and stared at him in fear, waiting for him to explode. He frowned, looked at her, swallowed and threw away the crust of his bread. All of it?
All of it.
But you must have some money still.
None.
Why not? You always had a great chest full of pennies buried under the floor.
Not in May.
I had spent it all on wool, every penny. And I borrowed £40 from poor Malachi, which I can't repay. I certainly can't buy you a new sword. I can't even buy a piece of meat for your supper. We're completely penniless.
Then how am I supposed to carry on?
He shouted angrily. His horse pricked up its ears and fidgeted uneasily.
I don't know,
Aliena said tearfully.
Don't shout, you're frightening the horse.
She began to cry.
William Hamley did this,
Richard said through his teeth.
One of these days I'm going to butcher him like a fat pig, I swear by all the saints.
Alfred came up to them, his bushy beard full of crumbs of bread, with a corner of a plum loaf in his hand.
Try this, he said to Richard.
I'm not hungry, Richard said ungraciously. Alfred looked at Aliena and said, What's the matter? Richard answered the question.
She's just told me we're penniless.
Alfred nodded. Everyone lost something, but Aliena lost everything.
You realize what this means to me, Richard said, speaking to Alfred but looking accusingly at Aliena.
I'm finished. If I can't replace weapons and can't pay my men and can't buy horses, then I can't fight for King Stephen. My career as a knight is over, and I'll never be the Earl of Shiring. Alfred said, Aliena might marry a wealthy man.
Richard laughed scornfully. She's turned them all down.
One of them might ask her again.
Yes.
Richard's face twisted in a cruel smile. We could send letters to all her rejected suitors, telling them she has lost all her money and is now willing to reconsider.
Enough, Alfred said, putting a hand on Richard's arm.
Richard shut up. Alfred turned to Aliena.
Do you remember what I said to you a year ago, at the first dinner of the parish guild?
Aliena's heart sank. She could hardly believe that Alfred was going to start that again. She had no strength to deal with this.
I remember, she said, and I hope you remember my reply.
I still love you, Alfred said.
Richard looked startled. Alfred went on, I still want to marry you, Aliena. Will you be my wife?
No,
Aliena said. She wanted to say more, to add something that would make it final and irreversible, but she felt too tired. She looked from Alfred to Richard and back again, and suddenly she could not take any more. She turned away from them and walked quickly out of the meadow and crossed the bridge to the town. She was wearily angry with Alfred for repeating his proposal in front of Richard. She would have preferred her brother not to know about it. It was 3 months since the fire. Why had Alfred left it until now? It was as if he had been waiting for Richard, and had made his move the moment Richard arrived. She walked through the deserted new streets. Everyone was at the priory, tasting the bread. Aliena's house was in the new poor quarter down by the quay. The rents were low there, but even so she had no idea how she would pay. Richard caught her up on horseback, then dismounted and walked beside her.
The whole town smells of new wood, he said conversationally, and everything is so clean.
Aliena had got used to the new appearance of the town, but he was seeing it for the first time. It was unnaturally clean. The fire had swept away the damp, rotten wood of the older buildings, the thatched roofs thick with grime from years of cooking fires, the foul ancient stables and the fetid old dunghills. There was a smell of newness, new wood, new thatch, new rushes on the floors, even new whitewash on the walls of the wealthier dwellings. The fire seemed to have enriched the soil, so that wild flowers grew in odd corners. Someone had remarked how few people had fallen ill since the fire,
and this was thought to confirm a theory held by many philosophers that disease was spread by evil-smelling vapors. Her mind was wandering. Richard had said something.
"What?"
she said. "I said I didn't know Alfred proposed marriage to you last year."
"You had more important things on your mind. That was about the time Robert of Gloucester was taken captive."
"Alfred was kind to build you a house."
"Yes, he was. And here it is."
She looked at him while he looked at the house. He was crestfallen. She felt sorry for him. He had come from an earl's castle, and even the large townhouse they had had before the fire had been a come-down for him. Now he had to get used to the kind of dwelling occupied by labourers and widows. She took his horse's bridle.
"Come, there's room for the horse at the back."
She led the huge beast through the one-room house and out through the back door. There were rough low fences separating the yards. She tied the horse to a fence-post and began to take off the heavy wooden saddle. From nowhere grass and weeds had seeded the burned earth. Most people had dug a privy, planted vegetables, and built a pigsty or a hen-house in the yard. But Aliena's was still untouched. Richard lingered in the house, but there was not much to look at, and after a moment he followed Aliena into the yard. "The house is a bit bare. No furniture, no pots, no bowls."
"I haven't any money,"
Aliena said apathetically.
"You haven't done anything to the garden, either," he said, looking around distastefully.
"I haven't got the energy," she said crossly, and she handed him the big saddle and went into the house. She sat on the floor with her back to the wall. It was cool in here. She could hear Richard dealing with his horse in the yard. After she had been sitting still for a few moments, she saw a rat poke its snout up out of the straw. Thousands of rats and mice must have perished in the fire, but now they were beginning to be seen again. She looked around for something to kill it with, but there was nothing to hand, and anyway the creature disappeared again. "What am I going to do?" she thought. "I can't live like this for the rest of my life." But the mere idea of beginning a new enterprise exhausted her. She had rescued herself and her brother from penury once, but the effort had used up all her reserves, and she could not do it again. She would have to find some passive way of life, controlled by someone else, so that she could live without making decisions or taking initiatives. She thought of Mistress Kate in Winchester, who had kissed her lips and squeezed her breast, and said,
"My dear girl, you need never want for money or anything else. If you work for me, we'll both be rich."
No, she thought, not that, not ever. Richard came in carrying his saddlebags. "If you can't look after yourself, you'd better find someone else to look after you," he said.
"I've always got you."
"I can't take care of you," he protested.
"Why not?"
A small spark of anger flared in her. "I've looked after you for 6 long years. I've been fighting a war. All you've done is sell wool." "And knife an outlaw," she thought, "and throw a dishonest priest to the floor, and feed and clothe and protect you when you could do nothing but bite your knuckles and look terrified." But the spark had died, and the anger had gone, and she merely said,
"I was joking, of course."
He grunted, not sure whether to be offended by that remark. Then he shook his head irritably and said, "Anyway, you shouldn't be so quick to reject Alfred."
"Oh, for God's sake, shut up," she said. "What's wrong with him?"
"Nothing's wrong with Alfred. Don't you understand? Something's wrong with me." He put down the saddle and pointed his finger at her. "That's right, and I know what it is. You're completely selfish. You think only of yourself." It was so monstrously unjust that she was unable to feel angry. Tears came to her eyes.
"How can you say that?"
she protested miserably. "Because everything would be all right if only you would marry Alfred, but still you refuse."
"For me to marry Alfred wouldn't help you."
"Yes, it would."
"How?"
"Alfred said he would help me fight on, if I was his brother-in-law. I'd have to cut down a bit. He can't afford all my men-at-arms. But he promised me enough for a war-horse and new weapons, and my own squire."
"When?"
Aliena said in astonishment.
"When did he say this?"
"Just now, at the priory." Aliena felt humiliated, and Richard had the grace to look a little shame-faced. The two men had been negotiating over her like horse-dealers. She got to her feet, and without another word, she left the house. She walked back up to the priory and entered the close from the south side, jumping across the ditch by the old watermill. The mill was quiet today, since it was a holiday. She would not have walked that way if the mill had been working, for the pounding of the hammers as they felt at the cloth always gave her a headache. The priory close was deserted, as she had expected. The building site was quiet. This was the hour when the monk studied or rested, and everyone else was in the meadow today. She wandered across to the cemetery on the north side of the building site. The carefully tended graves with their neat wooden crosses and bunches of fresh flowers told the truth. The town had not yet got over the massacre. She stopped beside Tom's stone tomb, adorned with a simple marble angel carved by Jack. 7 years ago, she thought, my father arranged a perfectly reasonable marriage for me. William Hamley wasn't old, he wasn't ugly, and he wasn't poor. He would have been accepted with a sigh of relief by any other girl in my position. But I refused him, and look at the trouble that has followed. Our castle attacked, my father jailed, my brother and me destitute. Even the burning of Kingsbridge and the killing of Tom are consequences of my obstinacy. Somehow the death of Tom seemed worse than all the other sorrows, perhaps because he had been loved by so many people, perhaps because he was the second father Jack had lost. And now I'm refusing another perfectly reasonable proposal, she thought. What gives me the right to be so particular? My fastidiousness has caused enough trouble. I should accept Alfred and be thankful that I don't have to work for Mistress Kate. She turned away from the grave and walked over to the building site. She stood in what would be the crossing and looked at the chancel. It was finished, but for the roof, and the builders were getting ready for the next phase, the transepts. Already the plan had been laid out on the ground, on either side of her, with stakes and string, and the men had started digging the foundations. The towering walls in front of her cast long shadows in the late afternoon sun. It was a mild day, but the cathedral felt cold. Aliena looked for a long time at the rows of round arches, large at ground level, small above and mid-sized on top. There was something deeply satisfying about the regular rhythm of arch, pier, arch, pier. If Alfred really was willing to finance Richard, Aliena still had a chance to fulfill her vow to her father, that she would take care of Richard until he won back the earldom. In her heart she knew she had to marry Alfred. She just could not face it. She walked along the southern side aisle, dragging her hand along the wall, feeling the rough texture of the stones, running her fingernails over the shallow grooves made by the stonemason's toothed chisel. Here in the aisles, under the windows, the wall was decorated with blind arcading, like a row of filled-in arches. The arcading served no purpose, but it added to the sense of harmony Aliena felt when she looked at the building. Everything in Tom's cathedral looked as if it was meant to be. Perhaps her life was like that, everything foreordained in a grand design, and she was like a foolish builder who wanted a waterfall in the chancel. In the southeast corner of the church, a low doorway led to a narrow spiral staircase. On impulse, Aliena went through the doorway and climbed the stairs. When she lost sight of the doorway and could not yet see the top of the stairs, she began to feel peculiar, for the passage looked as if it might wind upward forever. Then she saw daylight. There was a small, slit window in the turret wall, put there to light the steps. Eventually she emerged onto the wide gallery over the aisle. It had no windows to the outside, but on the inside it looked into the roofless church. She sat on the sill of one of the inner arches, leaning against the pillar. The cold stone caressed her cheek. She wondered whether Jack had carved this one. It occurred to her that if she fell from here she might die. But it was not really high enough. She might just break her legs and lie in agony until the monks came and found her. She decided to climb to the clerestory. She returned to the turret staircase and went on up. The next stage was shorter, but still she found it frightening, and her heart was beating loudly by the time she reached the top. She stepped into the clerestory passage, a narrow tunnel in the wall. She edged along the passage until it came out onto the inner sill of a clerestory window. She held on to the pillar that divided the window. When she looked down at the 75-foot drop, she started to shake. She heard footsteps on the turret stairs. She found herself breathing hard, as if she had been running. There had been no one else in sight. Had someone crept up behind her, trying to sneak up on her? The steps came along the clerestory passage. She let go of the pillar and stood teetering on